Usually, when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of just absolute precision.
Right, like engineering.
Yeah, exactly, like engineering. You break your arm, the X-ray shows that jagged white line on the screen, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is.
It's totally binary. I mean,
Yeah.
it's visible, categorizable, and honestly, highly comforting because it just removes all the ambiguity.
Broken or not broken, it's clean. But then, you step into the world of neurology and psychology and altered states of consciousness, and suddenly that X-ray machine is completely useless.
Oh, completely. You're flying blind.
Right. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is just incredibly murky. And well, that brings us to the core of today's deep dive.
Which is a heavy one.
It really is. We are unpacking something that has probably, crossed your mind, maybe sparked a bit of morbid curiosity in you, or even generated genuine anxiety. We are unpacking the exact literal brain mechanics of the infamous bad trip.
Which is a topic that carries, I mean, just immense cultural weight, a lot of historical stigma, and yet, on a strictly scientific level, is wildly misunderstood by the general public.
Totally. And our source for this journey is a truly fascinating, really comprehensive article from the OTW Journal.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
It's dated July 31st, 2026, and it's titled The Neuroscience of Bad Trips: Why Challenging Experiences Happen. And I just want to set our mission for this deep dive right up front for you.
Yeah, setting the table is important here.
The goal here is absolutely not to scare you, nor are we here to romantically endorse, like, reckless behavior. Our mission today is to literally take apart the machinery of fear.
The machinery of fear, that is, that's just a perfect framework for this.
Because what we will discover is that a quote-unquote bad trip isn't a malfunction of a drug.
Right. It's not a bug.
Exactly. It's not some random punishment from the universe or a sign that your brain is broken. It is a highly specific, deeply complex neurological cascade.
A cascade that follows rules, actually.
Yeah, and by understanding the literal cogs and gears of this mechanism, we can demystify the terror. We can learn which levers actually change the odds. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it. Where do we start?
Well, I mean, before we can even look at the brain, we have to throw out our cultural baggage.
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Because the pop culture image of a bad trip is just a cartoon, really.
Right. It's a total caricature from what, 1960s exploitation films?
Exactly. It's all tie-dye, melting walls, someone screaming in a corner while a sitar plays in the background.
And their friends are just staring at them helplessly.
Right. But the term bad trip itself, according to this research, is scientifically useless.
Scientifically useless. Why exactly?
Well, because it's a value judgment. It tells you absolutely nothing about what is actually happening under the hood.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to transition from these cartoon stereotypes to clinical definitions if we want to actually understand the science.
And this clinical shift in terminology, it isn't just semantics, right?
No, not at all. It's a structural necessity for the research. Modern neuroscientists and psychologists in this space completely reject the term bad trip.
So what do they use?
Instead, they use the term challenging experience.
Which I gotta say sounds a bit like corporate HR jargon at first.
It does.
Like, we aren't having a bad quarter, guys. We are having a challenging experience.
Yeah, right. Let's reframe this. But the article details how it actually has a very rigorous scientific backing.
Okay, lay that out for us.
So it's based on a highly validated psychometric tool called the Challenging Experience Questionnaire, or the CEQ.
The CEQ,
Yeah.
okay.
And it was developed by a researcher named Frederick Barrett and his colleagues back in 2016 at Johns Hopkins.
Oh, Johns Hopkins, they do a ton of work in this space.
They really do. And they realized that if they wanted to study these intense, difficult psychedelic states, they couldn't just sit in a lab and, hypothesize about what goes wrong.
They needed actual data.
Right. They needed a map of the territory.
Right.
So they built this questionnaire from the actual lived accounts of thousands of people who had, well, been through the fire.
And from those thousands of accounts, they unpacked what the research essentially categorizes as the seven flavors of harm.
Seven distinct factors,
Yeah,
yeah.
factors that make an experience challenging. And we need to look at these closely because when you actually break them down, you realize how dangerously inadequate the term bad trip really is.
It's flattening a huge spectrum of human experience.
Completely. So the seven factors are fear, grief, physical distress, paranoia, isolation, insanity, and death.
When you lay them out like that, I mean, the sheer diversity of human suffering becomes so apparent.
It's kind of heavy just hearing the list.
It is. Flattening all of those distinct psychological and neurological events into one colloquial phrase does immense damage to our understanding of the phenomenon.
Let's actually explore these flavors a bit because, you know, a wave of nausea, which falls under physical distress,
right, high somatic,
is completely different from a cathartic, weeping confrontation with buried grief.
Totally different. Think about the bottomless, primal dread of the fear factor.
Okay.
That is neurologically and experientially completely different from, say, the depersonalized, fractured terror of the insanity factor.
Wait, break that distinction down for me. Fear versus insanity.
Well, fear is the feeling that something terrible is going to happen to you,
or
right?
Like a threat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Insanity, on the other hand, is the feeling that the you who could experience the terrible thing is permanently shattered.
Oh, wow.
You fear you will never, ever return to baseline reality. Your mind feels literally broken.
That is horrifying. And then you have isolation. I found this one particularly chilling in the source material.
Yeah, isolation is a really unique one.
Because it's not just feeling lonely, right? It's described as a crushing, void-like aloneness, like a solipsistic nightmare where you feel entirely disconnected from the human race or the universe itself.
You can't just lump that existential void in with something like paranoia.
Right, because paranoia is, what, highly populated.
Exactly. In paranoia, the experience is highly populated, but everyone and everything in it is perceived as an acute, observant threat.
So you're connected, but it's all hostile.
Right. In paranoia, you are hyper-connected to the environment. In isolation, the environment just doesn't exist. They are diametrically opposed forms of suffering.
Man, naming these matters immensely. I mean, if you don't know what you're dealing with, whether it's unresolved grief surfacing from a childhood trauma or a genuine somatic panic attack manifesting as physical distress.
You don't know how I handle it.
You're lost. By naming these seven factors, the CEQ finally gives researchers and therapists a map. But I want to push back on this categorization for a second.
Sure, go for it.
You know, if this entire cascade is triggered by the exact same chemical, say psilocybin or LSD, hitting the exact same receptors in the brain, how on earth does it result in seven completely distinct flavors of terror?
It's a great question.
Like, is the brain just rolling the dice in that moment, randomly assigning you paranoia or grief? Or is the psychedelic just acting as a magnifying glass for whatever flavor of distress is already hiding in your subconscious?
The evidence points heavily toward the magnifying glass effect.
Really? So it's not random?
Not at all. The drug itself is pharmacologically completely devoid of grief or paranoia. There's no paranoia molecule in the mushroom.
Huh, right. That makes sense.
The chemical is merely a master key that unlocks a specific door in the cortex. It creates a temporary state of intense, hypermalleable neural openness, often called neuroplasticity.
Okay, so the door is wide open.
Yes. What actually rushes through that door, the content of the experience, the flavor of the challenge, is profoundly personal.
It comes from you.
It depends entirely on your history, your current psychological state, your buried traumas, and your immediate environment.
So the drug just turns the volume knob up to 11, but you're the one supplying the music.
Or the dissonant noise in this case.
Right, the noise.
If there is a well of unresolved grief that you've been actively suppressing for a decade, the sheer openness of this state allows that grief to surface with overwhelming, unmitigated force.
And what about paranoia?
Well, if you're baseline psychological tendency leans toward hypervigilance or anxiety, that same openness might manifest heavily as paranoia. The chemical catalyzes the state, but your mind populates it.
Which means we really need to understand the physical catalyst itself.
The starting gun.
Because we know what these experiences are clinically now, but we have a clear causal link to ask how they happen physically. What is the actual starting gun in the brain?
Right, the mechanics.
Because the OOTW article lays out a very specific three-step neurological cascade, and it all starts with one tiny receptor.
The 5-HT2A receptor.
5-HT2A.
Yeah. It is the absolute cornerstone for any classic psychedelic experience. When a substance like psilocybin enters the brain, it acts as a strong agonist.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning it binds to and aggressively activates this specific serotonin receptor. And these 5-HT2A receptors are not just scattered randomly around the brain.
Where are they?
They are densely expressed on the deep layer pyramidal neurons of the cortex.
Wait, pyramidal neurons? Picture the architecture of the brain for me here. Why does it matter that they are in the deep layer? And honestly, what does a pyramidal neuron actually do?
Okay, think of the cortex, the outer wrinkly layer of your brain, as a massive corporate office building with different floors.
Okay, I'm with you.
The deep layers, layers 5 and 6, are where the most crucial outgoing communication lines are located.
So they're the broadcasters.
Exactly. Pyramidal neurons are these large pyramid-shaped brain cells that act as the primary excitatory broadcasters. They send signals down to the older, deeper, more primal structures of the brain.
Okay.
When the 5-HT2A receptor is highly activated, it causes these deep layer pyramidal neurons to fire in a highly dysregulated, hyperconnected way.
And that firing triggers the first step of this terrifying cascade, which is the disruption of what neuroscientists call thalamic gating.
Right. And to understand the disruption, you really have to understand the normal function first.
Okay, explain normal.
The thalamus is a small egg-shaped structure deep in the brain, and it operates within a complex feedback loop known as the corticostriatothalamocortical model.
Okay, hold on. Let's definitely translate corticostriatothalamocortical model into English for the listener.
Fair enough. It's a mouthful.
A bit of one, yeah.
It's essentially a continuous conversation between the cortex, which is the thinking part, the striatum, which is a major relay station, and the thalamus.
Okay, cortex, striatum, thalamus.
Think of the thalamus as the ultimate sensory bouncer at the door of your consciousness.
I love that, the bouncer.
In your normal waking state, your brain is bombarded with millions of bits of information every single second.
Like what?
The hum of the refrigerator, the feeling of your socks against your skin, background traffic, stray memories, microfluctuations in your heartbeat.
All that data.
Right. And if you were consciously aware of all of this simultaneously, you'd be instantly paralyzed by sensory overload.
So the bouncer keeps the riffraff out.
Exactly. The thalamus filters it all. It gates the information, deciding what is important enough to send up to the cortex for your conscious awareness.
But under the heavy agonism of the 5-HT2A receptor,
the bouncer simply abandons the post.
Wow.
The gate swings wide open, the filter is drastically loosened, and suddenly a flood of sensory, emotional, and memory information pours in completely unscreened.
It's an overwhelming torrent of raw data.
Step one is absolute sensory and emotional overload.
So if the thalamic filter is gone and I'm basically receiving a million sensory inputs at once, how does the brain not just immediately short circuit into total panic? I mean, we usually have coping mechanisms for overwhelming situations.
We do. And that brings us to step two of the cascade.
Yeah.
The catastrophic weakening of top-down control.
Top-down control, meaning the cortex.
Specifically, the prefrontal cortex. Normally, your prefrontal cortex, the most evolved part of the human brain, located right behind your forehead, provides executive oversight.
It's the adult in the room.
It is the rational adult in the room. If you are watching a terrifying horror movie and your heart rate spikes, your prefrontal cortex steps in and says, "This imagery is frightening, but you are physically sitting on a couch.
This is temporary. You are safe. It's just a movie."
Exactly. It provides vital grounding context.
But the psychedelic cascade actively suppresses that top-down control. The executive system essentially powers down.
It goes offline, leaving you with a flood of raw, unfiltered feeling and memory from the loosened thalamus and absolutely no logical perspective or temporal awareness to contextualize it.
No temporal awareness, meaning you lose the sense of time passing.
Without the prefrontal cortex, you lose the concept of temporary. A scary thought isn't just a passing thought. It feels like permanent reality.
Oh, man. Which sets the stage for step three, the amygdala.
Yes. The fear center.
The amygdala is the brain's primitive salience and threat machinery. Its entire job is to scan your environment and your internal state for danger.
Right. It's the security alarm.
So with the sensory gates blown wide open and the prefrontal cortex totally off duty, the amygdala runs completely unchecked.
It just goes haywire.
It starts tagging ordinary, benign perceptions, a shadow on the wall, a sudden memory, a slight change in room temperature, as urgently meaningful or immediately life-threatening.
What's fascinating here is how these three mechanisms, the open gate, the silenced executive, and the hyperactive threat detector, perfectly converge to create an inescapable storm of overwhelm.
It's a perfect storm.
And the most vital takeaway from a clinical perspective is that this is not a malfunction.
Wait, really? It's not a malfunction?
No. The brain is not poisoned and the tissue isn't broken. The brain is doing exactly what an unfiltered, deregulated, hyperconnected network naturally does when faced with an infinite stream of unregulated data.
Let me try to visualize this. Imagine the brain is an exclusive, highly regulated nightclub.
I like this.
The 5-HT2A receptor is a VIP guest who walks in and tells the bouncer, the thalamus, to just leave the front doors wide open. Anyone and everyone can flood in off the street.
Total chaos at the door.
Then the club manager, the prefrontal cortex, who usually keeps order, decides to go on a coffee break and stops managing the crowd.
The adult has left the building.
Suddenly, the club's hyperreactive security alarm, the amygdala, gets tripped, and it's blaring at maximum volume, deafening everyone over absolutely nothing, maybe just someone dropping a glass near the bar.
Right, a totally benign input.
But there's no manager around to turn it off, no bouncer to clear the room, and no one to tell the crowd that it's just a dropped glass. No wonder your brain interprets that exact scenario as a life or death emergency.
The alarm is blaring, the doors are open, and no one is in charge. It captures exactly why the physical sensation of a challenging experience feels so viscerally, undeniably terrifying to the person enduring it.
It makes so much sense when you frame it that way.
But, you know, the neurobiology goes even deeper than the sensory and emotional systems.
Deeper than panic.
Yeah. We've established how your processing loses its regulation. But the ultimate terrifying peak of a challenging experience happens when the very entity experiencing all this chaos begins to disappear.
Ah, the dissolution of the self.
Yes.
We're talking about ego death. This is where the OTW Journal article gets incredibly profound. Because it's one thing to feel fear. It is an entirely different echelon of terror when the you that is feeling the fear starts to disintegrate.
It's hard to even conceptualize until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
This phenomenon is rooted in the breakdown of the brain's default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN.
Right. The DMN is a highly interconnected network of brain regions, including the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex, that is most active when we are awake, but not focused on the outside world.
It's the network that turns on when you're staring out the window on a bus, daydreaming, or ruminating on an argument you had yesterday.
Exactly. It is responsible for our self-referential thoughts, our autobiographical memory, and our mental time travel, you know, projecting ourselves into the past or the future.
So it's basically the narrator.
Yes. Neuroscientists widely consider the DMN to be the neurological seat of the ego, or the coherent, continuous sense of self. It's the narrative engine that tells you who you are from moment to moment.
And under a strong dose of a classic psychedelic, this entire network loses its synchronicity. It basically powers down and uncouples.
It falls apart. And the resulting dissolution of the sense of self creates a profound dichotomy.
Depending on the trip, right?
Right. In a positive psychedelic experience, when the individual is prepared, feels safe, and willingly surrenders to the process, this dissolution feels like profound mystical unity.
Like being one with everything.
Without the hard boundary of the ego separating me from the universe, the individual feels a sense of boundlessness, a beautiful oceanic merging with all things.
But if you don't surrender...
In a challenging experience, when this exact same neurological dissolution is met with resistance... When the ego realizes it is dissolving and tries to fight the process to stay intact, it doesn't feel like unity.
What does it feel like?
It feels like literal impending annihilation. This is the precise mechanism that explains the death and insanity factors on the CEQ we discussed earlier.
Wow.
You aren't just afraid of a threat. You are experiencing the structural end of your own existence.
And there is actual measurable brain chemistry dictating which way this goes. The article cites a landmark study by Mason and colleagues from 2020 focusing on something called the glutamate factor.
Yeah, glutamate data is fascinating.
So what is glutamate?
Glutamate is the most abundant excitatory neurotransmitter in the human brain. It is the go signal, heavily involved in learning, memory, and heightened states of arousal.
Okay, so it rests things up.
Exactly. Mason's team looked at brain imaging of individuals during these experiences and found a striking correlation. Higher levels of glutamate, specifically in the medial prefrontal cortex during the peak of the experience, strongly tracked with the negatively experienced version of ego dissolution.
The panic-inducing annihilation version.
Yes. Whereas a completely different, much lower glutamate profile in that area tracked with the blissful, oceanic boundlessness version.
That is wild.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains why the loss of the self model feels like literal biological dying to the mind.
Because the brain can't tell the difference.
Exactly. The human brain, on a primal evolutionary level, cannot easily distinguish between the end of the psychological construct of self, the ego, and the end of the biological organism.
It just reads system failure.
Right. When the self-model collapses, the brain's survival systems trigger the ultimate red alert, flooding the medial prefrontal cortex with glutamate as a frantic panic response to keep the system awake and defended.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. If the mind isn't broken and it's just the default mode network powering down naturally under the influence of the drug, why does glutamate get to be the deciding vote between profound spiritual unity and absolute annihilation?
It's the million-dollar question.
Is glutamate a cause of the resistance or just a symptom of the brain trying desperately to hold on to the steering wheel?
That question is at the very cutting edge of psychedelic neuroscience. Is the glutamate spike causal or correlative?
And what's the consensus?
The current working consensus leans heavily toward it being a symptom of psychological resistance translating into neurochemical stress.
Oh, it's a symptom.
When the individual feels their sense of self slipping and they react with fear when they grip the steering wheel, as you said, that psychological resistance creates massive friction.
Friction.
The spike in glutamate in the medial prefrontal cortex is likely the neurochemical signature of the ego fighting for its life.
Oh, wow.
The brain is effectively screaming, "We are dissolving! Deploy all excitatory signals to keep our narrative coherent." That internal war between the drug dissolving the network and the glutamate trying to force it back online is what makes the experience feel like madness or death.
It's the friction. If you let go, there's no friction. The default mode network dissolves quietly and you get unity. If you fight it, you hit the gas pedal, you get the glutamate spike, and you get terror.
That's beautifully summarized, yeah.
But hold on, I'm struggling with this conceptually.
Okay, what part?
We've just painted a terrifying picture of the brain on absolute high alert.
Right.
The thalamic bouncer is gone, the prefrontal manager is gone, the amygdala alarm is blaring, and your very sense of identity is fighting a losing high glutamate battle against dissolution. Why on earth would anyone willingly sign up for this?
I know, it sounds utterly absurd when you lay out the naked mechanics of the fear response like that.
It sounds like torture. But the answer lies in a massive paradox revealed by large-scale survey data. This brings us to a crucial pivot in our exploration, the paradox of pain.
Yes, the paradox.
Why difficult isn't always harmful. And this is backed up by some staggering numbers from a famous Johns Hopkins study.
Right, a landmark survey study led by Roland Griffiths, Teresa Carbonaro, and their team in 2016.
Carbonaro, 2016!
They managed to survey 1,993 people, specifically about their single most difficult, challenging psilocybin experience.
So they were looking for the worst of the worst.
They specifically targeted the hardest, most agonizing trips these people had ever endured.
Almost 2,000 people.
Okay.
That is a massive, highly robust data set for psychedelic research. And the numbers they found regarding the sheer scale of the difficulty are intense.
Of those nearly 2,000 people, 39% rated that single challenging trip as among the top five most difficult or challenging experiences of their entire life.
Top five of their whole life. Let the weight of that sink in.
Yeah, it's heavy.
When you ask an adult about the top five most difficult experiences of their life, you're usually talking about the death of a parent, a painful divorce, a severe physical injury, or surviving a major accident.
Paid life events.
And 39% of these people put a few hours on a chemical substance right up there in that top five echelon of suffering.
And it wasn't just internal psychological distress either. 11% of the people surveyed felt their panic was so severe, they put themselves or others at risk of physical harm during the experience.
11%. Which highlights the genuine behavioral risks when someone is trapped in a state of unmitigated, unfiltered panic without their prefrontal cortex to guide their actions.
Exactly.
But this exact cohort of data is where we hit the great paradox of this entire field of study.
The turnaround is incredible.
Because logically, you would expect these people to say, "It was a nightmare, I regret it entirely, it gave me PTSD, and it ruined my life." But that is not what the data shows.
The overwhelming majority of these same people, looking back in retrospect months or years later, rated the experience as meaningful or worthwhile.
The same people who said it was top five hardest.
Yes. Many of them cited that exact same top five worst experience of their life as also being one of the most spiritually or personally significant events they had ever undergone.
How can the worst day of your life also be the most meaningful? It defies common sense.
It comes down to the underlying therapeutic mechanism of these substances. Healing. In a deeply psychological context,
yeah.
Very rarely means feeling good.
We want it to, but it doesn't.
Right. Moving through acute, unresolved grief, confronting deep-seated systemic fear, or processing buried traumatic memories, That is agonizing, grueling work.
It's essentially surgery.
Yes. And that is exactly where lasting psychological benefit originates. Clinical researchers make a clear, vital distinction between a merely challenging experience and what they call an emotional breakthrough.
Emotional breakthrough, okay.
And the data shows it is the emotional breakthrough, not a pleasant, easy, visually pretty trip, that actually best predicts long-term clinical improvement in conditions like severe depression, existential anxiety, and PTSD.
So the very openness that makes a trip terrifying, the fact that your psychological defenses are stripped away and your thalamic sensory gates are wide open, is the exact same vulnerability required to make it transformative.
A challenging passage isn't viewed as a failure in a therapeutic setting. It's often recognized as the active mechanism of healing.
Because you're finally facing things.
You are finally facing the raw, terrifying things your default mode network usually represses to keep you functional. By facing them without your usual defensive architecture in place, you can finally process them, feel them fully, and integrate them into your waking life.
I hear that. But, I mean, where's the line between a necessary emotional breakthrough and just needless traumatic suffering?
It's a thin line.
It sounds dangerously close to romanticizing terror. If someone is trapped in one of the top five worst agonies of their life, feeling like they're dying or going insane, when is it actually healing and when is it just, well, awful?
That is an incredibly important pushback.
Yeah.
And the leading researchers absolutely warn against the romanticization of trauma.
Good, because that could get toxic.
Very quickly. The line between a healing breakthrough and needless damaging trauma entirely depend on the context in which it happens. Does the person have the support and safety to move through the terror, or are they left alone to be entirely overwhelmed and re-traumatized by it?
Context is everything.
If you confront a terrifying, buried memory of abuse while held in a safe, supportive, clinical environment with trained professionals, you process it. The narrative completes itself.
And if you don't?
If you confront that exact same memory alone in a chaotic environment with no context, the amygdala simply records another trauma.
Which means we need to talk about how we manage this. Having established that these experiences are profoundly powerful, potentially deeply valuable, but also agonizingly hard, you know, the listener absolutely needs to know. Are we just rolling the dice here?
No, definitely not.
Is it purely a lottery whether you get the mystical unity or the top five hardest day of your life? Or can this be actively controlled?
The good news from the neuroscientific and clinical community is that we're not just rolling the dice. The risk of a trip turning overwhelming is not fixed. There are highly influential, statistically proven, modifiable predictors.
Modifiable predictors. We're talking about the science of set and setting.
Yes, the golden rule.
And the Carbonaro 2016 survey data maps these levers out very clearly. They found that the risk of harm and severe challenge actively rises with a higher estimated dose, a longer duration of the trip, and, this is the most critical one, the absence of physical comfort and social support.
Those are the modifiable environmental factors, the setting.
Right.
But they're also established personality predictors, the set. Barrett and colleagues in 2017 found that higher neuroticism is a huge factor.
Neuroticism meaning what in this context?
It's a baseline personality trait characterized by a chronic tendency toward anxiety, self-doubt, and negative emotional states. They found it is strongly associated with a higher likelihood of having more challenging experiences.
So if your baseline state is already anxious, you're bringing more of that psychological resistance, that friction we talked about, right into the experience with you.
Exactly. What all this modern neuroscience, fMRI imaging, and survey data is doing is simply validating ancient indigenous wisdom.
Set and setting.
The fundamental concept of set and setting. Your internal mindset going in and the physical and social environment holding you. These are not just nice holistic ideas. They are the primary functional mechanisms of neurological safety.
The OOTW article really emphasizes the role of a sitter or a guide in this process. Their goal isn't to somehow stop the bad trip or turn off the 5-HT2A receptor.
They can't do that.
Right. It's to hold the hard experience, to reassure the person that it is temporary and help them move through it rather than trying to panic and abort it.
And this raises an important question, you know, why does social support actually work on a neurological level?
Yeah, if your brain's alarm is blaring at maximum volume and your thalamus is wide open, how does someone holding your hand turn the alarm off?
Because human connection acts as a literal neurological substitute for your silenced prefrontal cortex.
Oh, wow. A substitute.
Remember, your own internal executive function is offline. You have no internal adult voice saying, you are safe, this is just a drug, it will end at 4 p.m.
You're just raw emotion.
So the trained sitter provides that signal externally. A grounded, calm human presence sends profound evolutionary safety cues through a slow tone of voice, a steady heartbeat, safe touch, and a relaxed demeanor.
And that gets through.
Yes, it can bypass the flooded sensory systems and directly soothe the amygdala. The sitter essentially loans you their fully functioning prefrontal cortex until yours is able to come back online.
Loan you their prefrontal cortex. I love that. So what does this all mean? Let me try an analogy here to pull this together.
Go for it.
It's like deciding to sail a small boat into a hurricane. You cannot control the storm itself. That's the 5-HT2A receptor doing its thing, creating the wind and the rain and the massive waves.
Right.
But you have total control over the size of your boat. That's the dose you choose to take. You have control over the sturdiness of your hull and your rigging. That's your mindset, your mental preparation, your set. And you have control over whether you brought an expert navigator with you, your social support, your train sitter, your setting. The storm is exactly the same storm for everyone, but your survival. And whether you emerge with a newfound, profound respect for the ocean or just a traumatized, lifelong fear of water depends entirely on your prep.
The ocean doesn't care about your preparation, but your preparation dictates your experience of the ocean. You can't turn the waves off once you set sail, but you can navigate them if you have the right tools and the right guide.
And speaking of navigating, we've spent a lot of time talking about how difficult can be meaningful, how surviving the storm can make you a better sailor.
We have.
But to maintain complete honesty and responsibility with you, the listener, we must pivot to the hard boundary. We have to talk about where difficult crosses the line into genuinely medically dangerous.
It is essential to draw a firm line here. Most challenging experiences, even the most agonizing, terrifying ones, resolve entirely when the drug metabolizes and wears off. The storm passes.
But not always.
But real lasting risks exist, and they cannot be waved away by just saying, you know, it's all part of the healing process.
We cannot conflate a therapeutic struggle with a psychiatric emergency. The article is very clear that classic psychedelics can precipitate prolonged psychosis or mania in vulnerable individuals.
If someone has a personal or family history of schizophrenia, active psychosis, or bipolar disorder, the use of classic psychedelics is a strict standard medical contraindication.
They're screened out.
They are excluded from every reputable clinical research program on Earth for a reason. The profound deregulation of the brain's filters that we discuss, the thalamic gating opening, the DMN breakdown, can unlock latent, severe psychiatric conditions in those who are genetically or neurobiologically predisposed.
So the door opens and it doesn't shut.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In these individuals, instead of the default mode network neatly reassembling and the thalamus closing back up when the drug wears off, the system remains dangerously fractured. The doors stay open.
That is a very sobering reality. The drug can be a catalyst for a permanent shift if the underlying architecture is fragile. And there's also something called HPPD.
Hallucinogen Persisting Perception Disorder.
What does that look like?
It's relatively rare, but it is a documented clinical condition where individuals experience lingering, often distressing visual disturbances.
Like flashbacks?
Not exactly. More like halos around lights, visual trails behind moving objects, or a static-like overlay on their vision long after the drug has completely left their system.
Mm.
It's as if the visual cortex retains a shadow of the hyperconnected state.
Beyond the psychiatric and neurological, there are also acute physical and behavioral risks.
Right. It's not all just in the mind.
The article mentions cardiovascular considerations since these drugs work on serotonin receptors, and serotonin heavily affects vascular function, potentially spiking blood pressure.
Which can be risky for some.
Yeah, and there are incredibly dangerous interactions with other daily medications, particularly SSRIs or mood stabilizers like lithium, which can lead to fatal serotonin syndrome.
That is a huge medical red flag.
And as we mentioned earlier from the Hopkins survey, acute panic without supervision can lead to genuinely risky behavior. If you literally believe you are dying or in immediate physical danger, and you have no sitter to ground you and loan you their prefrontal cortex, you might try to flee your environment into traffic or act out erratically.
Which is exactly why modern clinical trials screen meticulously. They run EKGs, they control the dose down to the milligram, they test the substances in a lab for absolute purity.
No street variables.
None. And they keep two trained sitters present in a comfortable room from the very first effects to the full return of normal waking consciousness.
That is a totally different ballgame.
A challenging experience held inside that kind of highly controlled clinical container is fundamentally structurally different from one happening alone, unmeasured, and unprepared in a chaotic environment.
Which is why we have to reiterate the disclaimer from the OOTW Journal itself. This deep dive is purely educational. This is not medical advice. We are not recommending you go out and do this.
Please don't take this as an endorsement.
I want to highlight this for you, the listener, because it's vital. If the brain's filters are permanently damaged or a latent psychiatric condition is unlocked, all the meaningfulness in the world doesn't undo that harm. It feels like the entire point of this science, of mapping out these receptors and quantifying these risks, is to respect the sheer horsepower of these substances.
It is about deep, informed respect. These are not recreational toys.
No, they aren't.
They are profound pharmacological tools that temporarily alter the fundamental architecture of human consciousness. To use them without respecting the strict contraindications, without deeply respecting set and setting, is akin to performing open-heart surgery on yourself in a dark room.
In a dark room, yeah, that puts it in perspective. Okay, well, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Let's briefly recap the journey we've taken the listener on.
Sure. We started by throwing out the unhelpful, stigmatized term, bad trip, and replacing it with a clinical challenging experience.
And we unpacked the 7 distinct clinical flavors of hard, from primal fear to existential isolation to physical distress.
Then we looked under the hood at the exact neurological cascade. The 5-HT2A receptor acting on deep layer pyramidal neurons, triggering the complete loosening of the thalamic gate.
The bouncer leaving the door.
Yep. The shutting down of the prefrontal cortex's top-down executive control, and the amygdala running wild and unchecked.
And then we explore the dissolution of the ego via the default mode network.
And how the glutamate switch in the medial prefrontal cortex, driven by the friction of psychological resistance, can turn a feeling of profound unity into a feeling of literal impending annihilation.
Then we examine the great paradox of pain. How robust survey data proves that these agonizing, terrifying states are frequently rated as the most meaningful and worthwhile experiences of a person's life.
Because the radical vulnerability required for terror is the exact same vulnerability required for deep emotional breakthrough and lasting healing.
We talked about how to take control of the odds through set and setting, managing the dose, the mindset, and relying on social support to loan you their prefrontal cortex when yours is offline.
And finally, we drew the firm line at genuine red flags, respecting the horsepower of the chemistry and the strict psychiatric contraindications.
The goal was never to avoid difficulty, but to make it survivable, understandable, and integrable.
It provides a truly comprehensive map of the machinery of fear.
And to wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought. We've just spent this entire time looking at how terrified the human mind gets when its sensory filters drop, when its executive control pauses, and when the narrative construct of the self goes offline.
It's a terrifying picture.
But flip that around for a second. Think about what that implies about you right now, exactly as you listen to this.
Oh, I see where you're going.
If temporarily removing those breaks causes bottomless terror, a flood of overwhelming data, and the dissolution of your identity, then every single second of your ordinary, boring, everyday life is a miracle of active neurological engineering.
It really is a miracle.
Your brain is tirelessly working, filtering, and gating millions of data points every millisecond. It is meticulously maintaining the cozy, coherent illusion of you, just so you can calmly sip your coffee, drive your car, and listen to a deep dive.
Doing all that heavy lifting in the background.
The most mind-bending realization isn't what happens during a challenging psychedelic experience. It's the staggering amount of unseen effort your brain exerts every waking moment just to keep reality feeling normal, something to chew on for the rest of your day.